Sunday night, then that means from high above beautiful Lake Osceola in downtown Jefferson Valley, New York, the John Mack Radio Show is on the air. Good evening. This is John McMullen. Welcome to the 124th episode of the weekly John Mack Radio Show. The URLs for the previous 123 shows may be found at www.johnmack13.com. And John Mack is J-O-H-N-M-A-C. Mack, M-A-C, as I said, is johnmack13.com. And there's the radio show tab there. Just click on it, and you'll have the URLs, and you can download the MP3s for all of the previous shows. My most recent piece for the Westchester Guardian is at website www.westchesterguardian.com, and that's WestchesterGuardian.com. It includes the 193rd column, the Creative Disruption Series. I hope you'll read the columns, desire, comment to me at johnmack13@gmail.com. I also have a daily newspaper, and you'll find the link to, once again, at my website, www.johnmack13.com. It's free, and it's only one email per day. Next week's guest will be novelist Erin O'Riordan. And to this show, the 124th in the series, callers may call in at any time during the show by dialing 646-716-9756. That's 646-716-9756. My guest is musician, singer-songwriter, poet, and engineer Fred Gillen Jr. I first met Fred as the member with his wife Peg at St. Mary's Episcopal Church in Mohegan Lake, New York. Now let's get on with the show. Welcome to the show, Fred.
Thanks. Thanks for having me, John.
So let's start right at the beginning. Where did you grow up and go to early school?
Well, when I was 3 years old, my family moved from Pleasantville up to Verplank, where they bought a house. And I went to school at Cannon Verplank Elementary School, which is in the Henhud School District.
Did you think early in life of being a musician?
Not that early. No, when I was in elementary school, I was really, really shy, and in music class, I was pretty, you know, unwilling and terrified to sing in front of anyone. And the farthest I ever got was playing the recorder a little bit.
Did you have musical training as a child?
No, I did not. Not until much later in high school when I took a few lessons, but not many.
Where'd you go to high school?
I went to high school at Hendrick Hudson in the same district, and we lived there. Actually, we lived in Verplank until I moved out in 87 when I graduated, and my parents moved out of there and moved to Croton.
What happened after high school with you?
I basically just, even still in high school, I started playing in bar bands. At the end of my senior year, I was playing with these older guys, and we would play cover songs in the bars, and kind of did that for a couple of years until I got into my first original rock band, where I co-wrote songs probably around 1989. And I was also married the first time in 90.
So after high school, you went right into full-time work as a performer then?
No, at the time I had various part-time jobs as well, including in the beginning working for my father and my family's family business, which didn't last too long. I had to get out of there and eventually did some other different types of jobs.
What came first, the writing or the performing?
No, the performing definitely came first. I was originally a bass player, and that was really how I came at it. And the writing really started when at some point I was in one of the early bands. You know, we started trying to put some of our own songs together, co-writing them generally.
And who were some of the early bands? I didn't pick your bio up until 1996. Then you mentioned you started in the 80s. Who were some of the early bands?
Well, I'd say the first band that really was, you know, writing our own stuff was a band called Modern Mass. And it was sort of more of a progressive rock band. And then from there, I was in another band after that with another local guy, Eric Haight, great guitar player that's still around here. We had a band called The One, and then after that, I really got into my first band that took me towards doing this, you know, for a living, which is a band called The Rain Deputies, which was a much more of a rootsy alternative country rock band, really before anybody was calling it alternative country.
And how long were you with that band?
That band was 1992 to 1996 for me. So it was only 4 years. You know, it was at a time in my life in my 20s when it seemed like a whole lot of time to me.
Now, that took you up to the 96, your first solo concert. How'd you get into that?
Well, I mean, really, I guess the first thing I ever did was, I think my first solo concert might have been at One Station Plaza in Peekskill, basically because Nick Modern, you know, asked me if I could do a solo concert. I wasn't much of a guitar player, but I did it, and it was sort of terrifying, but I think I felt like it was something I could do, you know.
What got you from was there any training, or was it just the natural progression that got you from the shy kid to standing up by yourself in front of an audience?
Honestly, like, I think the first step was one week my wife at the time and I were very broke, and I went down to local store, the Bruised Apple, which then had a cafe in it, and I asked if I could play for tips, and, you know, I knew those guys, and they said, yeah, sure, and I played for tips, and I did all right, and I thought, well, this is cool, because this is low overhead, low profile. And I think I could learn how to do this, and I could probably, you know, I could get work doing this. Whereas with a band, it's really hard. It's really hard when you have four or five people.
I've seen some of your videos, and there are a whole bunch of different people that you've either partnered with or you've performed with. One of the videos was in Wisconsin. Who is Catherine Miles?
Oh, she's actually local. She lives, I guess it's really Mohegan Lake. And, she did a couple tours with me, as a background singer. And she and her husband have a band called the Ya-Ya's. And they're like, you know, they're local around here.
Then what about Matt Turk? He's been your partner at times.
Yeah, Matt Turk is a good friend, and we still play together. We still work together. He's also a Westchester guy. He lives down county in Hastings, and you know, besides being a songwriter and guitar player like me, he's also a really great mandolin player, and you know, is somewhat known around for that. He plays mandolin with a lot of people. But he and I became a duo because basically he was looking to put a band together to back him up. And at the time he had a manager, this guy, Tom Stouter, who knew me from the Rain Deputies as a bass player. And Matt and I knew each other, and Matt knew me as a singer-songwriter, but Tom suggested I could play bass in Matt's band. So we checked it out. I tried it, and I did that for a while. And then we ended up doing an acoustic duo thing, you know, really where we were a duo at some point along the way.
You also have recorded with the group called Hope Machine. Who are they?
Yep. The core of Hope Machine is a guy named Steve Kirkman and I. And then there's sort of a rotating cast of characters who are, you know, not band members. They come in and play with us when it's appropriate or when they can or when they're free or not busy. And there's sort of, you know, there's a few people that are sort of regulars with us, but basically it's a very loose thing. And the core of it is Steve and I. We, you know, play some of Steve's songs and some of my songs, and we co-write, and then we play a whole lot of like Woody Guthrie songs and Pete Seeger and things like that.
You're also currently doing some writing with the group called Hot Rod Pacer. Who are they?
Yeah, Hot Rod Pacer. I love that band. I wish we would do it more. Hot Rod Pacer started with my friend Jim Keys, who I'd done a couple of gigs with and just had run into a lot. And we always really got along and liked what each other was doing musically. And basically he asked me to take a trip with him to recover a bunch of vintage recording equipment that his dad had saved from the CBS 30th Street Studios in New York City. And while we were on that trip, we had to go all the way to North Carolina with a big van to get all this equipment. While we were on that trip, we wrote a song together in the van while we were driving. You know, one of us would drive and the other would hold the guitar and the pen. And when we got home, we decided to get together, write a few more songs. And as we were writing, I think we just decided that this needed to be a full-blown electric band. And actually, I had in mind to ask my friend Jason Hess to play drums because he's, you know, he sort of had some more time. And then at my wedding, Debbie Tuzman, who I think of as a violin player, reminded me that she plays bass and said she'd love to give a shot at playing with us. And I was psyched. And so she came in to play bass, and we've gotten her to sing a little bit too. That's Hot Rod.
You went from playing for tips in a coffee house to traveling all over the United States and Europe, playing both your own songs and as you mentioned, Woody Guthrie's and Pete Seeger's. How did this progression happen? How did you happen to get recognized enough that people wanted to bring you around the country and outside the country?
Yeah, I mean, that's a great question. And it's sort of a difficult question to answer. I would just say that when I became a solo artist, I decided I really wanted to tour and just, you know, make a record every couple of years and tour and do it. And basically it started with just making phone calls, probably even before much was done on email. And then when email kind of happened, you know, more sending emails and just constantly hustling and constantly making connections and then doing things that, a lot of it was like trying to do as many things as I could that felt right, felt like the right kinds of places for me to go and the right kind of things for me to do. And by doing that, it seems like I just kind of attracted certain people who, you know, just really, really were really behind what I'm doing. But I am independent, so it's really still just a matter of a lot of phone calls, a lot of emails, a lot of sort of shuffling things around and trying to make the schedule. And you know, sometimes I'll do a tour where someone else books it. Like I have a guy that booked me in Ireland who now books me almost every summer to come play in Maine for a week or two. You know, just kind of all around coastal Maine. They usually get me like 6 to 8 venues or something. And that's it, really. And sometimes other artists will take me in on shows and things like that. But it's really just, it's like any kind of almost like cottage industry, you know.
It's very interesting. You mentioned connections. My son is a TV writer and a game developer in California. And it's so important that you have connections. It's also so important that it doesn't appear that you're on the come all the time. What can you do for me? But that you
right.
you get to meet the right people and you get to interact with them. That's mm-hmm. It seems that no matter that in any independent work that you have to have that kind of the personality. And I remember people who got buyouts from IBM. And they got significant buyouts, and I'd run into them, and I'd say, "What are you doing?" And they'd say, "Well, I'm doing some consulting." Then I'd say, "How's it going?" And they said, "Well, not well, because no one's called." And they didn't get it that they were now an independent, and they had to be the person calling. You know,
yeah.
It was they were so used to taking direction. Do you have an agent?
I actually don't have an agent other than, like I said, I have a couple of agents that do a few little things for me here and there, but for the most part, it's all me. I don't have a manager or an agent. So.
You tell me about the Music Under New York program. What is that? That looks very interesting.
Yeah, Music Under New York is the people that you see in the subways that are playing in the subways, but they have a big banner with their name on it. And basically, like, if you're in the Music Under New York program, you know, you basically contact them. There's a certain 2 days a week or something where you're supposed to call and they book you to play at certain locations, like the kind of locations that everybody wants to play at, like Grand Central and Union Square. And you're allowed to be amplified, whereas if you do it freelance, you're not allowed to bring amplification. And basically, like, you have to audition. First, you have to submit your bio and your press kit and stuff. And then out of the people that do that, they pick, I think they picked the year we did it, they picked 70 people to audition. And then I think 15 or so got in the roster. And basically you just go down there and play and open your case. But you are protected by Music Under New York in a sense. And you know, you're legal and legitimate and you're scheduled to be at a certain place. Because like a place like Union Square, if they didn't do that, 15 different musicians would show up and they'd probably have fights, you know. So, but it was the audition process was really interesting because it was at Grand Central, and we had to go down there, and there were all these big wigs in the arts in New York sitting at a table, who were the judges. I think they had 15 or 16 judges, and they were people like maybe like the curator from the Metropolitan Museum of Art, or you know, sort of big people in New York arts. And, you know, you had to play, I think we got 6 minutes or something like that. And Turk and I went down there with he brought a mandolin and I brought my washboard. And we really think that we got into the program because of my washboard, because it was the novelty of it. It was just such a cool thing. And the day we auditioned, there were a bunch of reporters there covering this, and we ended up getting our picture in pretty much every newspaper in the country. And we think it was mainly because of the washboard.
Do you still perform there?
We haven't done it in quite a while. It's actually playing for a three-hour slot in the subways is pretty hard work, and it's you don't make a lot of money. Although what did happen was we got a lot of gigs. People would, you know, take a business card and they'd call us and play a private party, or we actually got a gig at a place called Coogan's in Washington Heights. That was a weekly gig for a couple of years, and the owner of the place really became a good friend of ours, and you know, got a guy that I'm just really grateful to know.
Which one, Peter Walsh?
Peter. You know Peter?
But he's a good friend, and I was recently at a he collected over the years. He studied literature in Ireland, and he collected over the years this very impressive library, and he recently donated it to the Gluckstern Art Center at NYU. Then I was down there, and then one of the books is an original James Joyce, and apparently when Joyce had his works published, they had very little money. It was published by the French publisher, and depending on how much money that they had, it was printed on various grades and quality of paper, and Peter had one that was very unusual. So it was donated to them. Peter never stopped. Mm-hmm. He's one of the funniest guys in the world, I think.
So, he is. He's a guy that you know. I'm so happy that I got to be friends with him. And he came up and recorded an album up at my recording studio, and I actually played at the United Palace Theater in his band for the album release for that. So
I didn't even know that he had a band. I know that he studied at Marist College, and that he was in the first group that went as Marist brought to England. And when they got over, he and his roommate in some way got involved with Peter O'Toole and all these wacko drinkers, and they're out there all the time with them. So when this brother who we knew, who's the late brother Joe, went over there as the moderator, he got into their room and he said, how did you study? There's no desk in this room. And Peter said, oh, we go to the library. So Joe didn't quite buy this. But they took him out to a musical with the tool and the group, and he came back after it, and he said, this is what it's supposed to be. You got immersed into the culture, you know. So he was very happy about that. So he's a good guy. Do you know Dave Hunt too, his partner?
Yeah, I know Dave too.
Dave's just the opposite to Peter. He's quieter until you get him going. Dave's from my old neighborhood. Dave's from Inwood, top of Manhattan Island. But Peter has a band? I didn't know that.
Yeah, Peter actually named it McCombs Dam Bridge, the band. He's got a voice like you would not. If you never heard him sing, it's unbelievable.
Oh yeah.
it's like a crack opened in the earth and the sound came out. It's incredible. And when he gets on stage, it's like his head is going to explode. He just becomes like James Brown. He becomes like larger than life. But he is larger than life anyway.
He certainly is.
I really, really love him. And actually, his son came up and recorded at my studio as well, Connor. So
now that, you know, that takes us in into another part of your life as an engineer with your own recording studio. How did that happen?
Well, I got the recording bug not long after I became a musician, like in high school, and started with little cassette tape recorders, started recording myself and, you know, the bands I was in high school, and then ended up with the four-track recorder, and then I ended up with an eight-track machine with half-inch tape, and sort of just always had the bug. I hung around a couple of studios a bit when I could, when I could get away with it, and just really started doing it myself. And probably in about 96 also, just when I was starting my solo thing, for the first time I recorded somebody else's band. It was a guy that I have since done four or five projects with, named Chris Barrickman. He is from Bedford, but now he lives in Brno, Czech Republic. And I recorded his album, and we did it on a four-track machine. And he got great reviews in these folk magazines and stuff, like Dirty Linen, and I can't remember the name of the other ones. But that was sort of it. I really started recording people for free. I made a bunch of records for people for free, and then I just started charging, you know, a little bit. I had very, very bare bones equipment. I just had a couple of, you know, a few microphones and a you know, some kind of little cheap mixing console. And when the computer thing started, when the digital thing started, it sort of made it a little more accessible financially. And I really just have been collecting equipment for years and years, and I've piled a pretty amazing collection of vintage microphones and equipment. And then eventually Steve that does Hope Machine with me helped me to build this, you know, this recording room down in the barn on my parents' property in Croton. Basically, my dad was moving his business out of there, and there was this barn that he was storing some equipment in or whatever that was just rough. It was just sort of pretty much unfinished. It had a couple of horse stalls in it. And so my buddy Steven and I ripped that stuff out and, you know, built a basically soundproof room in one room, and then built the control room and, you know, started. But first thing I did was we did Steve's solo album at the time, Rhodes. And actually we had a recording session with Pete Seeger like the morning after we finished putting the wood on the walls together. That was our first session.
As an aside, Peter Walsh has been the previous guest on the radio show. His the MP3s at the site. It's interesting.
Oh, cool.
The recording studio. I was It seems to me that musicians get it better than others. I remember years ago, Barbara and I covered the rollout of Sam Ash's professional recording studio in New York.
Yeah.
And they were also doing it. They were introducing the program that at that time was only on the Macintosh or on very expensive machines called DigiDesign. And
yeah,
they made a big deal that it was a non-destructive editing program. And there were musicians there were engineers with the pocket protectors in their shirts trying to explain it, and there were marketeers. And it really didn't get across till this little guy wearing the motorcycle jacket with spiked hair and two drumsticks in his back pocket started talking about it. And he understood the whole thing. And he was the drummer for the Joe Cocker Band. So he was able to put things into understandable English for the crowd better than the engineers who built the system or the salespeople who were trying to sell it.
That wasn't before, Eric Parker, was it?
It was whoever he was.
Yeah, it might have been Eric Parker, actually, because he was in the Joe Cocker band for a while.
A short guy with dyed blonde hair. Spiky kind of
back
hair.
Back then he might have had dyed blonde hair.
Okay.
That would be funny. He was in that band for a while.
So we have all these connections that you and I didn't know about. Peter Wallace and other stuff. Before we get into where you played then everything and your recording business, do you want to play something for us?
Yeah, sure. I'll play a song called The Ghost of Joe Hill.
Okay.
That I wrote not too long ago.
I understand who Joe Hill was. Do you want to tell the audience before you start playing who Joe Hill was?
The song basically tells the story of what Joe Hill did. And it's a real simple folk song. So I think the song at least tells that part of the story pretty clearly. So I don't think I need to intro it too much in that sense. So.
Okay, take it away.
Joe Hill stood on his head, bebop, in squares and on the docks, trying to organize the men. You've got power if you've got friends. Joe Hill. Ghost is in us all. Joe Hill. Every worker standing tall. Salvation Army band showed up. Trumpets and tubas to shut Joe up. To drown him out, they played real loud. When they were done, they dispersed the crowd. Joe Hill, every worker standing tall. Joe was discouraged, but he would quit. He had an idea, and he worked on it. He wrote, and he learned to sing songs of its trouble to the square he brings. Tunes of the Salvation Army band, simply so the people could understand. He sang songs of organization. They were repeated all over the nation. Augmented by trumpets and tubas they rang. Message grew stronger as the people sang. Workers organized and the workers fought. Country has changed forever. Joe Hill. Ghost is in us all. Joe Hill. Every worker standing tall.
Unfortunately, to the audience, the sound from the recording of the phone and the singing did not come off that well. So, where can we get the lyrics to that? Are they up on your website?
They are. Yep. My website has a lyric page. It's organized by album, and that's on the album called Wage Love.
Okay. So. Okay. When I send the URLs out, I will publish your website also.
Great.
You also then as your career started to move, you also have songs done various television shows like All My Children and some of the MSG soundtracks. Tell us about that.
All My Children was a song called Free, Basically, I was working with this publisher that had a song library, and they would, they would position songs to TV shows. I think they did mostly HBO, but they did a little bit of ABC and other networks as well. And then the MSG show actually was, that was a reality TV show that Matt Turk and I were on, which was, it was Subway Musicians. It was a show about Subway Musicians, and there was a contest aspect to it. And then they also came up to my studio and filmed an episode, or part of an episode up in the studio. We sang a couple of songs for that. And they also filmed us both playing and being interviewed down in the subway, I think in at Union Square once, and I think up in Harlem once as well. And that was, so that was all live stuff, you know, footage that they took of Turk and I.
So how did that relate to the MSG mission of sports, Madison Square Garden? How did that relate?
I think it just filled some time when there was no sports.
Okay. You also received the New York State Foundation for the Arts grant that allowed you to go to Europe. Explain that.
Yeah, basically, I was doing a tour in mostly Germany, and I had one show in Prague as well. But I applied for a special opportunity stipend, they call it the SOS grant, and I actually got it, and it paid for my airfare to Berlin and back to do that tour, which was a huge help because, you know, the flight to Berlin was not cheap. It wasn't like flying to London or Paris. At the time, it was pretty expensive flight, and it was, you know, I felt really honored to get the grant because they mostly go to visual artists, I think, just because more visual artists apply because visual artists are more plugged into the idea of getting grants.
So how did you hook up with your European tours? How did you get that going?
European tour was a friend of mine had just gone to Germany through this booking agent over there and said, dude, you got to call this guy and get booked over there. They'll love you over there. And the same thing happened when I toured Ireland. It was the same kind of thing. It was, you know, another artist that I knew in each case, you know, turned me on to the agent who was doing these tours. And 6 months later or 8 months later or whatever it was, I found myself doing, I think I did about 20 shows in Germany and then one show over in Prague.
Now, what's the background of Gillen? Is it Irish or is it German? What's the ethnic background of the name?
Yeah, the name is Irish. It was something like O'Gillane, and the Gillens, that part of my Irish is from Donegal. But I am actually German too. My grandmother's name was Mueller, which is a pretty common name in Germany. So, and I'm Irish in another way through her family too, which their name was Chambers and they're from Clare. There's more.
Did you grow up knowing Irish music? We were exposed to it?
Not really. I can't really say that I ever remember hearing Irish music in the house or anything like that. I think the first Irish music I was ever aware of was probably not until I was 20-something.
I grew up in an Irish Catholic Jewish neighborhood, and we used to go to Rockaway when that was mainly Irish. And we'd go to one bar, and the drinking age then was 18, so you could be in these bars early, and would go to Bleachrum Castle on 103rd Street, and then after we drank beer there, then we'd walk across the street to Mickey Carton's Mayo House. And Ruthie Morrissey sang there. And she was an Irish legend. And she used to sing The Dying Rebel and The Green on the Green. And they both became big records on the jukebox in the bar we hung around. They knew the Broadstone. And years later, when I used to go up to Guinan's up in Cold Spring, or in Garrison, Jim Guinan sang "The Dying Rebel" for me, and I really like that song. Did you know Jim?
I knew him just a little. I went to the session at Guinan's a couple times towards the end, so I met him, but I didn't know him well or anything.
The fellow who used to lead that band and passed away was a fellow named Jack McAndrew. Well, I don't know if you knew around the neighborhood as a local museum. It was amazing on the first Thursday after the full moon.
Yeah.
They had what they called the rising of the moon, and musicians from all over the Hudson Valley that played all these weird Irish instruments, the spoons, you know, and the tin whistle.
Yeah.
They'd all show up and they'd play into the middle of the night. And I remember being in the kitchen one night on a November night, standing next to George Pataki, trading our basketball stories. Mm. He lived right up the hill, and he was the good friend of Guinan.
Yeah.
You also went to South time Southwest. That must have been very interesting. Good musicians from all over the country show up there.
Yeah.
Tell us about that.
Yeah. That South by Southwest was sort of, it was a bit overwhelming. Like, I go to the Folk Alliance conferences sometimes, and it's a little more manageable. But South by Southwest was like, it was kind of a cross between just completely overwhelming and crazy and being a kid in the candy store. And I mean, when I first got there, when we got there and went up online and got our credentials and stuff, I went into the bathroom and I was, you know, I was standing there taking a leak, and I looked next to me and Chip Taylor was standing at the urinal next to me, and I thought, this is amazing. So, but we did a gig. I think it was called Maggie Mae's, the place. It was on that main, I think it's 6th Street in Austin, where a lot of the clubs are. But yeah, it's amazing.
You also mentioned that the first person that recorded at your studio was Pete Seeger. How well do you know him?
How well did I know Pete? I got to play with Pete a bunch, and I got to spend way more than my share of time with him. I always felt like, in a way, like, he barely knew me because I didn't open my mouth much when I was around him. You know, mostly I might ask a question just to get him talking about a certain subject and then just shut up and listen. But Pete maybe kind of thought of me as like the Woody Guthrie jukebox in a way. Cause there was one time where he was singing Do Re Mi and he forgot the words and he called me up to help him out. So I think he maybe, you know, connected me with being a younger person who was really interested in Woody. But I got to play with him, you know, a good handful of times over the years. And the last time I saw him was Steve and I, the guy in, you know, Hope Machine. We backed up Pete for the Spirit of Beacon Day with my friend Susan Wright, with a group of Beacon school kids from Sargent Elementary School, where she teaches. And that time was beautiful because you know, he kind of gave me a hug when I was saying goodbye to him at the end of the gig, and he had never done that before. So it was, I was really psyched about that because, you know, he was... I basically would say, in a way, like, I kind of stalked him, kind of followed him around. But, he was in my studio for 2 full days. That was how I really got to know him at the beginning. And then there were a couple of people three people in particular in my life that just went out of their way to put me on stage with Pete, put me in the room with Pete, you know, whatever. And those people were Matt Turk, Susan Wright, and David Burns, who produced Pete at 89, the record Pete at 89. And he also produced the album Pete Remembers Woody, which I have a Woody Guthrie cover on the album. And it's an album of Pete telling stories about Woody Guthrie with, you know, other people singing the Woody Guthrie songs. So I'm grateful for those three people who are like my Pete Seeger angels in my life, who constantly put me in the car with Pete, put me in a room with Pete, put me on a stage with Pete. They were looking out for me, I think.
I think that he was, that he's been dead 2 years as of yesterday, I believe.
A couple, yeah.
You mentioned the school kids. I remember years ago seeing him. He was, I lived in the Riverdale area of the Bronx, and and Pete's brother was the principal of the Fieldston Middle School. Mm-hmm. And one Saturday, Pete just got out on the lawn there and started singing to the kids and their parents and the neighbors. It was terrific. Then another time I saw him in at Gaelic Park, Crow Park, down by Manhattan College, and he kept the price down. It was something like $4 to get in to the concert, and it was raining, and there's a few hundred of us all standing around, not in the in the stands, with umbrellas up, listening and sing along with them. He had the very captivating way of drawing the audience in. You mentioned Woody Guthrie. I know that Bob Dylan has always talked about the influence that Guthrie had on him. How did you get involved with the Woody Guthrie Foundation?
Well, my story with Woody Guthrie really starts with Dylan, like many people, you know, probably in my generation, because when I was probably still in high school, I got really into Bob Dylan, and I was into all punk and heavy metal and stuff like that up until then. I was into other things too, but that's the way I leaned. I got into Dylan, and on Dylan's first record, he has that song for Woody, and that really got me interested in Woody Guthrie, and I read his book, Bound for Glory, and that was the first thing that hooked me. And then years later, it's really kind of interesting how I got involved with Nora and Anna at the Woody Guthrie Foundation, because basically I went up to the town crier to open mic, and I played a couple songs at open mic, and there was a guy there, Frank Mathias, who had a Friday night radio show on WKZE. And he contacted me the next day or something, and he said he had a cancellation on Friday night where I'd like to come play a show. And so that's kind of how I got to know Frank. And then about 6 months later, I got a phone call from Woody Guthrie's granddaughter, Anna, and she said, Frank Mathias gave me your number, and I'm putting on an event. I need some people, you know, local people to sing Woody Guthrie songs. He said, you were the guy. And that was how I got involved with them. And that's how my group Hope Machine started, because those guys were there, separately playing a set. Todd Judice and Steve Kirkman. The three of us became Hope Machine, and then, Todd kind of dropped out of it not too long after that. He had other stuff going on, and Steve and I have kind of kept going for 10 years. But a big part of that was doing events, for either for the Woody Guthrie Foundation, or more often they would ask us to play at events they were putting on to raise money for the Huntington's Disease Society of America.
Okay. Speaking of these two people, you've also opened shows for people well known through the area. My ex Congressman John Hall, who did the You're Still the One, which is one of my favorite songs. Also, another local Hudson Valley fellow, Todd Rundgren, and the famous Merle Haggard, who got torn apart by those on the left of the fighting side of me, which he said wasn't really his political philosophy. But tell us about those people.
Yeah, and the Merle show was fairly recently, and boy, he was great, and his band was great.
Tell us about being involved with them, with Peter Yarrow, with Rungan, with Haggard, and with John Hall.
Well, Peter Yarrow, I've played with a couple times now at benefits for. Well, first I jammed with him a little bit at Clearwater, but that was kind of informal. But then I played a couple of benefits for Moms Demand Action for Gun Sense in America that Peter was the headliner. And so we would usually all do a big grand finale. Although I remember at the one show, Steve and I opened the show and we played an old civil rights song called Ain't Gonna Let Nobody Turn Me Around. And Peter came running up and sang it with us. But then, you know, we all played together at the end of the show. So that was my, you know, that was my situation with Peter Yarrow, which was really, really nice. And he was great. He, you know, he hung out in the green room and all of that. And then the Todd Rundgren show, the Merle Haggard show, actually, those were both at the Tarrytown Music Hall. And I also did an opener for, solo for the David Bromberg Big Band at the Little Theater in Long Island, and those all came through Scott Seltzer, who works with Music Without Borders, who books those places, and Scott's a local guy. He's also a good singer and songwriter, but he really keeps me in mind for these different shows, and he'll call me and say, I have a show that'll be good for you, or I have a show that'll be good for Gillen and Turk, or, you know, Hope Machine, or whatever. So most of those big openers really have been local, and they've been for Music Without Borders shows.
Rungan was one of the early people to be involved with graphics in the background and computer generation and using computers to do things. He was very early in the game, and he was close with a friend of mine that actually had the composition that you know, the Macintosh sent into space with Voyager. Laurie Spiegel.
That's
cool. So what about John Hall? I understood that recently he was in poor health. Is he okay now?
Oh, I don't know. I didn't know about that. You know, I played some campaign events when John was running, and you know, so he'd always jam with us and stuff. In the case of John Hall, when Gillen and Turk, when our record was out, we had a manager who had been Matt's manager, Tom Stouter, and Tom, his other job was he was John Hall's campaign, what the heck was this? I guess he's like the press guy. You know, he was like the I don't know what they call it, but like the guy that, you know, dealt with the press and stuff. And so I think the first time that Matt and I played with John, we were playing at Clearwater, and Matt has a song called Mr. President, so we brought John up and we sang Dear Mr. President, but you know, when he was running for Congress, and did a couple songs with him at Clearwater, and then we ended up playing some, you know, like I said, a couple of fundraisers, like for his congressional campaign, and he was great. You know, he was really, really down to earth, and really. It was funny because he would jam with us, and he wasn't really playing much at the time because he was, you know, he was busy running for Congress, so he probably didn't have the guitar chops he normally had. He was way better than either of us, but he would always, like, apologize and say, you know, I haven't really been practicing much.
The last time I had the longest conversation with him, there was he was a congressman, and they had a benefit in the FDR Park. There was a student who had put together this wonderful thing of musicians and speakers and everything, raising money for charity, and Richie Havens was the keynoter. So Hall showed up because he knew Havens, and there was a columnist who used to write for a local paper, Rita King. And her husband opened. Her husband had the band, which I can't think of the name of the band, but fella named King. You also did some work with Tom Chapin, Harry's brother. What kind of work was that?
I've played. First of all, Tom Chapin is like one of the nicest guys in folk music, I think. I've played some benefits with him, a bunch of them, actually. We did one, maybe it was a different year than the one that Peter Yarrow did, or maybe it was even the same show up at the town choir, you know, Tom did. And then I did a really small benefit for the Floop Club up at the Nature Center at Croton Point. But actually the first thing I ever did with Tom, and I got to do it a second time eventually, was one of the coolest things, which was there was a big benefit show for Woody Guthrie's medical bills. I think it was in 1966 or 5 or something. And Dylan famously recited this poem that he wrote about Woody at it. This radio guy in Jersey on WFDU that I know at the Folk Alliance one year, he decided to essentially stage a reenactment of that show. And he got a bunch of different artists who he knew had some connection to Woody Guthrie to play at it. And what he did was he got Tom Chapin to be the voice of Woody Guthrie. So Tom was the narrator and did a lot of speaking. He's got that great, speaking voice. So that was actually the first thing I did with Chapin, and then we got to do that again at the Hurdy Gurdy in Fairlawn, New Jersey, right after the big Hurricane Sandy. We just happened to be scheduled to do this Woody Guthrie event to raise money for a local food pantry out there, and it turned out that it was the week of Hurricane Sandy. So at that show as well, Tom Chapin was the voice of Woody Guthrie. But he's been, every time I've done one of these things with him, he's been really, he's just really friendly, really nice guy. You know, one of my favorite guys I've met, like in the folk world.
He was one of the sponsors of the Harry Chapin mini marathon years ago. I know that they still have it, but it was in Croton Park, and my daughter, who was a very good runner, she won the woman's section of it. It was the 6 mile race, so that was neat. You also had the song that was on one of my favorite NPR shows that's not around anymore, Car Talk. How'd that happen?
Basically, I wrote this song called This Old Car, and I just recorded it. I was working on the album that was going to be on. And I don't know, somebody said, hey, you should send that to Car Talk. I said, oh, yeah, that's a great idea. I sent it in, and maybe 6 weeks later, they used it. They played a good 2 minutes or 2.5 minutes of it. And that was exciting because I loved the show.
Click and Clack. They have an excellent book that I bought years ago, and it's more than just the cost of it. It's their political philosophy and everything. It was very well done. You mentioned the Clearwater the number of times. Was your involvement the before or after the Don McLean falling out with Seger? Did you know McLean?
No, I never knew McLean. Everything I've done with Clearwater has probably been in the past 10 or 12 years or so. That's
okay. McLean's an Iona grad where I went, so every now and then his name comes up. Now, you also had a song 2 years ago that was recorded by the band that I don't know about, Solar Punch. Tell us about Solar Punch.
Yeah, Solar Punch is a band that started as a solar-powered rock and roll band that played a lot of songs about alternative energy and the environment, but they did it with solar power. When they do a gig, they bring a whole bunch of solar panels, and they have a whole setup and a whole system. And they also host solar stages at music festivals where they come and they bring the solar powered rig. And basically, like, they recorded 2 records at my studio, and then they went on a pilgrimage to Nepal, this famous pilgrimage up in the Himalayas. That sort of traces part of the steps of the Buddha's life. And while they were on this trip, basically they were asked to bring instruments they could carry on their back and to sing for the people that were on this trip. They had been taking Hindi lessons and sort of learning about music from India. And when they went on the trek, they also brought a song of mine called Sing, 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 and sang it up in the Himalayas with these trekkers. And when they got back, they called me. They said, we want to come in and make another album. This music is completely different. It's acoustic. We're playing 3 instruments. We're each playing 1 instrument, and the bass player played ukulele, and the guitar player played bouzouki. And they came into my studio to make an album, and they said, oh, by the way, we're going to record your song, Sing, Sing, Sing. So they did it. It was wonderful because they also have, besides bringing it to India and Nepal, they also played it for a whole bunch of people down in Haiti. Just awesome.
Now, your recording studio is named after Woody Guthrie. How did that happen?
There were a bunch of reasons for that. I mean, part of it was just sort of a play on words because it's all wood. The whole room is wood. It's all the recycled wood from the horse stalls that were there. But it was also the guys that helped me build it are, you know, guys that I was playing Woody Guthrie songs with, and we felt like Woody Guthrie had kind of brought us together. And so we thought that would be a cool reason to name it Woody's House. And because I named it Woody's House, I had some stuff, I had some things that I was going to hang on the walls about Woody Guthrie. And then Anna Canoni from the Woody Guthrie Archives called me up, and she said, hey, I heard your name in the studio after Woody. I want to give you some more stuff to decorate it with. So she gave me a little statue, like a little bust of Woody that they sell, and she gave me a poster from when Woody was inducted into the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame, and a couple of other things.
Terrific.
She actually
terrific.
Gave me. So it's, yeah, it was really nice.
Now, you mentioned your song on someone else's album. I don't understand the music business that well. How does it work if they then sell the CD with your song as one of the 12 songs on the CD? What do you get out of that? Because they may not have bought the CD just for your song, but it's on there. How does that work?
Yeah, basically, like with covering songs in general, there's a standard royalty rate, which these days is based on the length of the song. It used to be that any song up to 5 minutes was the same, but nowadays, thanks to computers and all that, it's a little more like prorated based on the length. But basically, yeah, I mean, when somebody records one of my songs, they pay me it's pretty small, but they pay me a little bit of a publishing royalty for the number of, you know, number of units that they make. And then, technically there's also a digital component for downloads, which is, I think the rate may be a little bit different for that. I'm not sure, but it's all standardized, basically.
It's interesting. I've got books up on Amazon, and I also have some eBooks. And periodically, I'll get the monthly check from Amazon, and
yep.
For the hardcover, it's pretty. I mean, for the paperback books, it's pretty good. For the ebooks, it's like 99 cents a download or something. It's interesting. Some of the, and you may be aware of this, some of the early Crayola scandals. And I was the rock and roll fan and rhythm and blues. And what Alan Freed used to do, who was the big guy in New York, he would get to play songs. He would get his name put on as a writer.
Yeah.
Then if you look at two of the great rock and roll songs of all time, Sincerely, that was big for the Moonglows, even bigger for the McGuire sisters, and Maybelline, Chuck Berry's song, his name is on as a writer. Now, I think Berry sued at one point to have his name taken off, but I mean, he didn't have to take money. He could just pick a song, and if it took off like Sincerely did, then it was money in the bank for him, you know.
Yeah.
Every
and month. same thing happened, like, you know, for example, with Elvis. You know, like Elvis got co-writing credit on things that, you know, he didn't co-write. He just basically, the Colonel would say to the writer, "Look, Elvis will record your song if you give him writing credit." And so it was, you know, and actually Dolly Parton was offered that deal late in Elvis's career with that song, "I'll Always Love You," and she said no. And then Whitney Houston ended up recording it, and she probably made a fortune on it.
That was a terrific song, yeah. The one that he probably did not get that for was Paul Anka's "My Way," or mm-hmm. I forget who wrote, because one of my favorite singers too, "In the Ghetto," but Elvis sang both of those, and probably the other people they were too big for him to force in that, particularly since Sinatra had the first hit on
right.
"My Way." The last year you brought out a solo album, "Wage Love." Tell us about that.
Well, "Wage Love," the title actually came from the guy that does my cover art. When I sent him the song, when I sent him the music and the photographs that I had, he wrote to me and he said, "The album is called Wage Love." I said, "Okay, whatever you say." So that was where the title, but the title comes from, I've been giving away stickers at my shows for the last dozen years that say "Wage Love" on them. So I think he just felt like this group of songs, maybe it fit, and it was time for me to have an album that was actually named that way. But it's, you know, it's sort of a, I don't like to use the term political because I don't consider it political, but I guess it could be construed as somewhat more political songs for me. So they're just songs like Woody Guthrie, songs about what's going on in the world, basically, I'd say.
Now, as your career moves along, at some point, the touring will become a drain. Will you go more and more into the production business, or do you plan to just keep singing for as long as your voice holds out?
I definitely plan to keep singing because I love it, but I have slowed down on touring quite a bit, not so much because of it being tiring, it's because it's become harder and harder to really make any money doing it. So really what I'm shifting toward is, you know, just playing more locally and regionally and less on the road. At the same time, also doing a lot more engineering and producing. Because I really love the work equally, that between playing and singing and being in the studio. It's really, you know, I love the studio because I really get a chance to help other musicians and artists get to do their best, you know. So that I feel calling with that work as well, I'd say.
Now you have played a number of times at the local Pigskill Brewery, where some of the profits have gone to either St. Mary's that I mentioned earlier, or to the food pantry. How did you get involved with St. Mary's in Mohegan Lake?
St. Mary's started with, I met Mother Claire when she was, I think, at St. Peter's. She had been coming to see me play at local coffee house in Croton, the Black Cow. And she called me. She contacted me and asked me to play at a World AIDS Day event. And so I said yes, I did it. And I got to know her a bit that night. And not long after she got to St. Mary's, she asked me if I would help her to facilitate an alternative service on Wednesday nights. And I thought she just wanted me to play some music or something. So I said, yeah, sure. But she actually wanted me to, like, help her facilitate it. She wanted me to actually be a part of putting it on and doing it. So when I found that out, I said to myself, I should at least go to church there once or twice and see what it's all about. And the thing was, I grew up Roman Catholic, but on 9/11, there was this thing where the president said, everybody go to like your house of worship on Friday at noon. And so I did that, and what I did was I lived right near St. Peter's. This was before Claire was there. I went to St. Peter's, and I felt really comfortable at an Episcopal church. So later, years later, when Claire got me, it was a sort of easy, it was an easy fit. But I really, from the beginning, I really loved a lot of people, and I love the fact that the people from Mohegan Park come to church with us at St. Mary's, even though I don't really get to the 9:30 service where they go too often. In the beginning, when I first started going to St. Mary's, I started playing music at the family service, and then soon Claire switched me from that to getting involved with the youth group, which I did for, I guess I did it for about 4 years until I kind of got burnt out. So that was cool. I really loved being able to just jump in and get involved, and I really got a lot out of working with the kids.
Now, I mentioned earlier that Peter Walsh is the prior guest on the show. Mother mm-hmm. Claire was my second guest on the radio show a long time ago. And I also had, to keep it ecumenical, I also had my senior Tom Sandy, who was at that time cool. was at Satan. But like you, I grew up as a Roman Catholic, and then I'm at St. Mary's now. You also got married at St. Mary's, didn't you?
I did, yeah. This is my second marriage, and it was great. Our wedding was fantastic, and of course, Mother Claire knows us pretty well, so that definitely helped. But, you know, she's, I mean, she also did my mother's funeral and Peg's mother's funeral less recently. And I think she does great with, you know, with weddings and funerals as well, because I think even if she doesn't know the people as well, she finds a lot out. Like when my mom passed, she came over to that. She knew my mom a little bit, but she came to the house and spent about 3 hours just asking us questions. And so when she did the service, you thought she was old friends with my mom, you know. So, but at the wedding, she managed to incorporate a Blues Brothers reference and a Monty Python reference. That was cool.
Well, that's her own background, her aborted a stage career. So,
yeah.
We've touched a whole lot of bases tonight. What else might you like the audience to know about Fred Gillins? Then how do they get your albums?
Well, the easiest way to get the albums is if you go to my website, there's info there. There's a couple of the site I steer people to is called Bandcamp. And if you Google Bandcamp and you just type in my name, my page will come up with all my albums. But you can also download them on iTunes and places like that if you don't want the actual CD.
Now Bandcamp is Bandcamp, one word,
yep,
or two words?
And I guess it's two words, but either way it will work. You'll get it.
And Gillen is Gillen.
Now,
what haven't we talked about that you might like the audience to know?
Man, we've talked about a lot. I guess that's, you know, because this will be archived, you know, no point talking about concerts or dates because, you know, it's people want to find out where I'm playing, they can look at the website. So, yeah, I mean, I think we've touched on a lot of stuff. I can't really, off the top of my head, I can't think of all that much else. And we got to talk about Peter Walsh, which was great because I didn't, you know, I'm going to go back and listen to that show because I didn't know you knew him, and just wonderful, wonderful person.
Well, thank you very much, Fred. It's been a real pleasure.
Thanks.
A bit of commercial information. My column now appears biweekly in West of the Guardian, along with regular columns by congressperson and co-chair of the 9/11 Commission, Lee Hamilton, and critic John Simon. West of the Guardian is available in print format and online, as I mentioned before, at www.westoftheguardian.com. My books are available at Amazon, and I blog at johnmack13.johnmackrants.com. That's JOHNMACRENTS. And in the words of Mets radio announcer Howie Rose, after the Mets win, put it in the book. Go to my website, www.johnmack13, for URLs of previous shows and a schedule of upcoming shows. And join us next week for a conversation with novelist Aaron O'Riordan. And until then, as they used to say in the old neighborhood, see ya. Whoa, Silva. Whoa, whoa, Silva. Whoa. Thanks again, Fred, and I will talk to you later.
I'll hopefully see you Sunday, or I think. Yeah, I think I'll be there next Sunday.